You're listening to Homicide Worldwide. Your host, Sally Inquieto, would like to remind our listeners the episodes deal with crimes that are graphic in nature and may not be suitable for all listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
For joining us here tonight at Homicide Worldwide Podcast. A quick shout out to all the folks who are supporting us by listening every week. We are so grateful to you all. If there is a case that you would like to hear us talk about, please email suggestions to homicideworldwidepodcast@gmail.com and we will get to that as soon as we can. Please follow us on social media, on Instagram and Twitter at Homicide Worldwide Podcast. And finally, please keep telling your friends about us because it really helps our show. We hope you enjoy it this evening. We'll see you back next week. Good evening, folks. If you are new here, welcome to our show. And if you've been listening to the show for a while, you know that we don't run from a good old-fashioned dismemberment. It's a topic that we find ourselves talking about a lot here at Homicide Worldwide. It isn't intentional, it just sort of happens organically around here. It gets peppered in from our very first Israel Keys all the way up through now, and I'm sure that there are going to be many, many more going forward, since there is no shortage of people out there who like to remove the body parts of other people out there. So Sally and I got to thinking, since we talk about this subject frequently, why not dedicate an entire episode to everybody's favorite subject? And so for tonight, we bring you something a little different, a little special, a dismemberment buffet, if you will. From early forms up until its current use today, dismemberment has, and I suspect, always will fascinate and horrify. Grab a plate. It's an all-you-can-eat experience tonight. This is episode 24 of Homicide Worldwide.
What is up?
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm so glad to be here. I'm good. For those of you who are just checking in, my name is Sally. I'm one of your co-hosts.
And I am Kita. I am the other one of your co-hosts.
And together we form Homicide Worldwide. Thanks for being with us. We're trying something a little bit new tonight. If you've come here often, and we hope that you do, you've noticed that we usually focus on a particular person or murderer or a series of murders or a particular event. And this week, we're taking kind of a different tack. We have decided to focus on a theme, the theme being dismemberment.
Everybody's favorite subject.
Something that you yourself are somewhat interested in, Kita. Like, I find it quite fascinating too, but it's something that you've mentioned a couple of times as being an area of particular interest.
You asked me earlier why I was interested in dismemberment and why it's always kind of been something that I focus on. Basically, it's just an extremely interesting means to an end to me. Like, it's the overkill with it. It's like what goes into it, just kind of like the mindset that somebody has to be in, especially after I got really into some of the details that we're going to talk about later on. It reinforced it even more to kind of take a step back and be like, holy crap, like, just the planning and then the execution of it, literally the execution of it.
The literal physical execution of it.
Yes.
And what goes into it, it is not a particularly easy thing to do.
No.
You need particular tools. You need particular ways to, I don't want to be too graphic, but here you are.
No,
at
they
a dismemberment
want it.
They want it.
They want it.
They are, you're here at a dismemberment podcast. So we're going to do away with the, oh, it's going to be graphic.
Yeah.
Okay. You guys already know what you're here
exactly.
for.
It's a dismemberment party.
You said that's why we're here.
Right.
But you know, you got to be able to clean up. Like your Joel Guy Jr. really think ahead and plan shit, man.
Yes.
Get some plastic sheeting.
But then don't use it. It is an extremely methodical thing to do. I mean, there are dismemberments, sounds weird to say this, that are done very, very well. Mm-hmm. And then there are just some sloppy ass examples out there of dismemberments that go horribly awry. You know, the dismemberment gets away from the person and they become overwhelmed and they don't know what to do. And then all of a sudden it's a disaster.
I really feel like the difference there is experience. You got your Joe guy who's maybe doing it, maybe possibly for the first time. And then you've got your Catherine Knight, who can take the skin of her boyfriend off in one, and I quote, pelt. Where, and even like the nostrils were intact, the eyelids were intact. Yeah. Like that's some skill. Like regardless of how disgusting it is, a professional leather worker would be hard pressed to do something like that. We're going to take a little tour tonight. We're going to kind of take you through a little history of dismemberment. We're going to kind of define it because there's sometimes some confusion about what's what. And then we're going to go back to some of the cases that we have talked about so far in the history of our podcast and examine how dismemberment was used in those cases and the different motives or reasons people had for selecting that as a choice. So let's kind of start with a little bit of why dismemberment is so interesting. For me, there's a couple of reasons, and I managed to find a few very good sources on it. So one of the most interesting things about dismemberment as a crime is that it's extremely rare. So only about 2% of homicides in Europe, for example, involve mutilation or dismemberment. And in other parts of the world, that goes down to about 1 in 500.
Jeez. So,
yeah, it's surprisingly unusual once you start talking about all the homicides that are committed.
Yeah.
We are also wired to be disgusted by dismemberment. It is a sort of evolutionary wiring that we have. There's this professor of anatomy and histology named Ian Gibbons, who is at Flinders University, which is in Adelaide. I know, the hometown touch. It just happens so often.
Yeah, no wonder you were excited about this.
I was excited about it. And he wrote this article for a website called The Conversation, and it was called More Than the Sum of Our Parts, Why Dismemberment of the Dead Irks. And in this article, he really tried to describe why it is so super disturbing to us. And one of the things he talked about was that neuroscience has looked at how we think of ourselves in our bodies and how our consciousness creates this awareness of our bodies. So this is kind of a direct quote from this article. It takes considerable brain power to build up our conscious perception of our own body. The feeling of existing in an intact body that moves through space and time is a construct that our brain makes using a vast array of sensory inputs. And those come from, you know, our muscles, our tendons, ligaments, bones, skin. So the brain matches these inputs of what we're feeling, what we're thinking, how we're interacting, all of this sensory stuff with these internal models of our own body. And so when things line up of like, I'm reaching out and I'm touching that and my hand feels it, we have this very specific sense of ourselves in our bodies as like the pilots of our bodies. We kind of feel ourselves in time and space. When we observe another living body that has been dismembered, our brain signals that this is obviously an abnormal situation. It's very unusual. And what it does is our brain puts what we know of as a whole body through our own experience with this visual of this disarticulated body and finds this really horrific mismatch. And that dissonance is what we find so disturbing. We also get this instinctive, almost below consciousness level reaction of seeing something so horrible. On some level, we know that in order for a body to be in pieces, it has definitely suffered an extremely violent event. It's a very good idea to get away from a situation where that might also happen to your own body. And so part of it is that I don't want what happened to that dude to happen to me. So we are disgusted, but we're also drawn to these experiences, which is why these feelings of disgust, which is really evolutionarily determined, and fascination, which is also evolutionarily determined, of what happened here? I want to find out more. How did this happen? They kind of are together inside us. And that is one of the reasons that dismemberment is so fascinating, is because these two separate things are kind of at war inside us. And I personally do feel that. I feel disgusted by it, but I feel fascinated by it. And I think anyone who's listening to this is probably feeling the same.
When I was doing my research on this, you type in dismemberment, a lot of times it's just insurance that pops up, like, you know, accidental death and dismemberment. Yeah. And so I'm like, that's not what I want. That is not what I'm looking for.
Sounds like a boring ass podcast.
Tonight, we're going to talk to you guys about accidental death and dismemberment insurance.
Unsubscribe.
Exactly. When I was looking it up, I kind of had to dig a little bit to find a lot of the really graphic things that I was looking for this. I swear, if anybody ever looked in my computer history, I would be immediately sentenced to death.
5150, baby, you're out of here. Yeah.
The photos that you can discover. I mean, you dig deep enough, you can find anything on the internet.
And so you really can.
When I was looking, I mean, my God, the remains of these people, like, it didn't look real. It was very, it just looked artificial, and they weren't, but it looked like it was. And you just have to think, holy fuck, this person, like, whether this happened during like their waking alive moments or was it like post-mortem, like, that body went through some shit. It's just, it's the most incredible thing what can happen to a human body.
But that unthinkability, that thing that you just described.
Yeah.
That's a real thing. It's actually something that has been studied, that idea of, like, we can't conceive the mindset that you would have to be in to be able to do these things. But there are profilers and researchers who actually study this, how people are able to attain this mindset.
It was equally, and to go back to what you were saying just a second ago,
yeah,
it was equally as disturbing as it was fascinating. I couldn't stop looking. I was like, oh God, oh my God, oh Jesus. You know, as I was like going through it, and I was like, next. You know, I couldn't help it. It was just the most morbid curiosity, but it was just fascinating.
And it's funny that you should say that, because I had a similar experience, and I found it so reassuring to read that feeling of revulsion and fascination was actually like hardwired into my brain. Like, I feel like there's almost like a little bit of shame in, like, normal people don't look at this. Yeah, they actually really do.
Well, can I just say though that I have all those feelings on the reg anyway, and it has nothing to do with dismemberment photos.
I'm always like that. I'm like, I'm not a normal person. Normal people wouldn't do this stuff. I'm like, I feel like everybody's really thinking that. You know, this is only weird to us because we're so detached from what it used to be like in the world until about 15,000 years ago when we invented agriculture and civilization happened. But before that, we were living in tribes and you would see everything.
That's true.
Still gross though. So there are characteristics of people who can do this stuff that we just don't have. This is why we find it horrible. Mm-hmm. This is why we probably will never be able to do it. Although, you know what? When everyone put in a stressful situation, who knows? You know what?
You don't know what you're capable of until you're in the situation.
Exactly. There was a forensic psychologist, Helena Hakanen Nyholm. Mm-hmm. She worked in Finland and she did some research about empathy and killers and dismemberment and stuff like this. And she found that lack of empathy and inability to properly experience emotions are a characteristic of this kind of killer. She also says that you can't presume that the offender would have felt what you would have felt. You can't presume that they would have felt anxiety, horror, or guilt when they do these things.
Yeah.
You would. I would. We'd be like, oh God, oh, I'm cutting into him. Oh God, oh, it's disgusting, right? You can't assume that the person who is doing it did that. And that's one of the things I hadn't really pondered until we did this episode, that just because I feel that way doesn't mean that a person who's doing this would feel that way.
Because some people do this type of thing for the pleasure of it. That's the way they get their excitement.
That's right, exactly. We'll get to those people. As there's some real interesting ones. But then you get people who do it, who are doing it for practical reasons.
Yeah.
Who also seem to be just fine with it.
Exactly.
That's the part I find very interesting. So dismemberment is interesting for a variety of reasons. There's a couple for you, but mostly it's rare. We are wired to be disgusted and fascinated by it. And also for most of us, because we just aren't made that way, it's unimaginable. So watching our fellow humans do it is like, whoa, how is this even possible for these people?
When you think of, most of us don't associate human beings as being animals.
Mm-hmm.
I personally kind of think we are animals. We're just more complicated animals.
Yeah, we're very fancy animals.
Exactly. You had mentioned something when we were talking about doing this that it reminds us as people that we are meat.
We're just meat.
And it's really disgusting to stop and think about the concept of that we are meat.
I had this conversation with the children one time. They asked me what we were made of. I said, we're made of the same things that animals are made of. We're made of bones and ligaments and tendons and muscles. And
proteins.
One of the children said, meat?
Oh, my God. That's awesome.
I said, yes, we're made of meat. So let's dive a little bit into what dismemberment really is. And you smarties all think you know what it is. And for the most part, you're right. So dismemberment is the act of cutting, tearing, pulling, wrenching, or otherwise relieving the limbs from a living thing.
I love that the use of relieving the limbs.
Yes, so
is
polite.
It really is. Yeah, it really makes it sound a lot prettier than what it is.
It's a little posh.
Exactly. Your torso has now been relieved of its arms. Carry
it's
on.
Almost like it barely happened.
I mean, you didn't need those anyway, right?
So it has been practiced upon human beings for a very long time. Capital punishment. It also happens as a result of traumatic accidents. Anyone who has attended a plane crash will tell you, you are not looking for whole people. Obviously, speed has a massive impact on how many pieces you're likely to find. Specifically, it's about removing limbs.
Mm-hmm.
You can make a distinction between dismemberment and decapitation, but it's kind of still the same thing. It's removing large parts.
Yes, a large, very important part from the body.
Very important parts. In criminology, there's really two kinds of dismemberment with a bunch of subsets. They make a distinction between offensive dismemberment, in which dismemberment is the primary objective of the offender, and defensive dismemberment, in which the motivation is more for evidence destroyal or to conceal. There are, as I said, five main subsets of this. Again, defensive kind of is part of that subset. So defensive is about hiding or moving the body or getting rid of evidence, or also making identification much more difficult. So we saw that a lot in some of our research, and I was reading about the Long Island serial killer, and the Long Island serial killer would remove the head and the hands a lot.
Yeah.
And dispose of them in separate places to make identification difficult. Another of the subsets of dismemberment is aggressive type. So this is when the killing and the later dismemberment are brought about by the same aggressive emotions, part of the same act, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Another type of that would be dismemberment, where dismemberment is the cause of death. So the dismemberment itself causes the death. You don't want to go there too much in your mind.
But yeah, we're going to.
Yeah, we're going, but I just did. Fuck. All right. Then we've got offensive dismemberment. That is where, again, dismemberment is the real purpose of the murder all along. These are, I mean, you could make an argument for something like a Dahmer, who he's like, I kind of want to eat parts of your body, and you really can't do that unless they've been removed. So that's kind of the point of it. There's psychotic dismemberment, where there's just no touch with reality anymore. Somebody's having a psychotic break. There was a case not too long ago where I think it was in Turkey, where a 57-year-old lady got murdered by her daughter, who was about 33. The daughter took her apart afterwards and was having a really big psychotic break. I think she had schizophrenia at that point. And of course, not everybody with schizophrenia does anything like this. And we wouldn't want to suggest that they do.
Like, right. But in that case, she did.
In that case, she did. And the last type is this sort of as a warning or a message or a threat to others. The kind of things that you would see the mafia do, where it's not just enough to kill someone. It's if you dismember them and sort of display their body parts around town or do something horrible with them or with a horse's head. It really does send a very strong message. So
yes,
there are these subsets of dismemberment, but there's also decapitation. And Kitty, you've got some stuff about that.
Yeah. Decapitation, it's kind of just the ultimate show of power. It's something that you do to another human being to really sort of exert yourself over them. It's like the ultimate theatrical show to let the world or tribe or people or whoever it is that you're trying to make the point to know that you cut the head off your enemy and don't fuck with me. Pardon the pun, but no matter how you cut it up, it is... No matter how you slice it, it is always shocking. Decapitation is full commitment to the act. And anytime it happens, regardless of whether it's a war crime or a murder, which obviously war crimes are murders, it definitely proves to everybody else that you have taken the life of that person whose head you're now holding. And the head also represents kind of just who we are as the person, right?
Like soul, spirit, like humanity, like our personality. Like,
yeah,
I feel like even very early humans, even without, you know, all the benefit of, you know, philosophy and science and medicine, I feel like even then they kind of understood that the head was something different. You could lose a hand,
right?
Maybe, or, you know, you could get injuries to other parts of your body, but like the head's kind of like a deal breaker.
Well, the head's the hub, right? It's where you process your emotions. It's where you have your expressions.
In terms of our senses too.
All the senses revolve around the head. So the head of another human being really represents who that person is. And so when you decapitate somebody, you are sending a message that is essentially, it's a trophy, it's a win, and it's an exertion of power to show everybody that, hey, don't fuck around.
Yeah, you really can't go past it in terms of just riding into town with it on the end of your jousting stick or something.
Right. That sends a message, no matter where you are, no matter what era you're living in, whether you're talking about, you know, Vikings or people of today, it sends a message. If I was to go into work, you know, with my arm out my window as I'm rolling up to work and I had, you know, somebody's head on a stick, probably people are going to have a lot more respect for me at work.
I think there's going to be a lot of respect for you. I think the respect will come first and the arrest will shortly follow thereafter.
They're like, we're going to go ahead and let you go.
Yeah, okay, Kita, I'm just going to have you sit right here. Do you need a cup of coffee?
Yeah.
You need a plate for your head?
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe a bowl?
But it sends a message, right? So ultimately, that's sort of the point of decapitation.
So there's one more level of dismemberment. It is sort of the most complete level of taking the body apart. Sometimes it's referred to as, this is disgusting, the pink mist.
Tell us more about that.
It's called total body disruption, and it's just what it sounds like. So this is the step on a landmine situation. This is where, to get you back together, they need like a broom and a shovel. Sometimes it's referred to as being blown up or being blown apart, turned into a pink or red mist. In ye olden times, they would say dashed to pieces. So total body disruption is the most severe type of blast injury. So specifically, these are blast injuries, but they can also happen from a terminal velocity fall. Mm, mm-hmm. So that's like, and not, you're not landing, you know, in a bunch of like garbage, you're landing on the sidewalk from like 20 stories up.
Yeah.
And it's just, you kind of explode a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because you're essentially a bag. You're a fancy bag, which has a skeleton, but mostly you're a bag. And 70% of you is liquid. So when you hit the ground at a fast speed, you're kind of going to go sploosh and explode.
Can I say something really fast?
Yeah.
We're friends with a police officer. And
this is going to be good.
And he had some photos of a train that had hit a person.
Oh, Jesus.
And what you're talking about is exactly what happened.
You just explode.
Unfortunately, it was a suicide. And that person just literally exploded everywhere. There was nothing identifiable. I don't know how they fixed that.
Sometimes you can get a tooth or a couple of teeth and match it to dental records. Sometimes it's like DNA is probably the easiest way at that point. But total body disruption is, I like that they use this word, non-survivable.
Oh.
Yeah. It's pretty, when you're a mist or you're in pieces like that, it is non-survivable.
I would have gleaned that just from total body disruption.
That's right, exactly. And when you have undergone total body disruption, the pieces that are left are referred to as dissociated portions.
Oh. That's so clinical.
It is very clinical. So that's total body disruption. That's kind of like the maximum level dismemberment. You see that happening a lot in armed forces with explosive weapons, IEDs, landmines, any kind of bomb will do that.
Yeah, that is incredible. Well, and that, you know, it goes back to too, like, you know, when they were trying to clean up the landmines and everything and all the places that they've been hidden. I mean, imagine how many people have just accidentally stepped on something like that and...
Yeah, kabloom.
Yeah, that's a shitty way to die. You have to hope that that's fast.
My impression is that it is instantaneous. This is the kind of thing that happens instantaneously. It's like 1 second you are a human being walking through a field and the next second you are just... Like, not even second, millisecond. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know what? As ways to go, it's probably very painless.
You probably don't know. You hope that you don't know that it happens.
Yeah.
Maybe did for you a ever quick see, second.
For a quick second, right? Maybe. I don't think I'd really want to know. Did you ever see the Oregon exploding whale footage?
No, I don't want to see that.
Oh, no, it's fantastic. So there is a dead whale washes up on Oregon Beach way back when. It starts to really stink. And so the authorities are like, how do we get rid of this whale? Yeah. It's disgusting. There's seabirds everywhere. It smells terrible. And so some genius is like, we're going to blow the fucker up. And everyone gets on board with this fantastic plan. We're going to blow it up. And so they stick all this dynamite under this whale. And there's footage of this, news footage of this. People, do yourselves a favor and Google the Oregon exploding whale. But dismemberment applies also to animals, so this is legitimate. And so they blow the crap out of this dead whale, and red mist is the first thing that happens. And it's just like, whale turns into red mist, like, boom, red mist. But then what they really overdid it with the dynamite. And all these chunks start raining down on the cars in the parking lot nearby.
Oh my God.
And there's just like pieces and people are screaming.
You know, a whale is a massive creature.
Yeah, and it's also been rotting for like 2 weeks at this point.
I was just going to say.
Rotting whale flesh rain, essentially. But that's a good story. People, you should look it up.
Well, this kind of brings us to a slightly different angle of dismemberment. I focused on the history of dismemberment, primarily the uses and methods of dismemberment, where it relates to punishments.
Tell me, but don't tell me.
Oh, you want to know. Each of the following punishments that I'm going to talk about really varied by country, but from what I could gather, most countries in the world had some form of these types of punishments, and it was shocking to me that some of them were used until fairly recently. One of them was used within our lifetime, Sally.
Are you shitting me? What was it?
I am not shitting you. You're just going to have to wait.
Oh my God.
So the first one that I have, it's called the breaking wheel. The breaking wheel was a large spoked wheel that a prisoner could be murdered by, essentially. But the primary goal of the breaking wheel wasn't actually to kill the person. It was to mutilate the body before the person was killed. With these breaking wheels, we have to think of these are like you said, ye olden times, right? So these massive wheels that are huge and they've got, you know, iron in them to make them strong so that they don't, you know, break.
Wouldn't want them to break.
We wouldn't want the breaking wheel to break. So they're really, really heavy, right? And so the person would be kind of strapped down, and they would start, for the most part, with this by taking this wheel, and, you know, they have these little pulley systems, and they would hoist it up above, and they would drop it on the person's legs. They started from the bottom. There was a method here, because...
Wait, they dropped the wheel on their legs?
Yes.
To break their legs?
Yes. It, like, mangles the body. And what ends up happening, they take this and they repeat this over and over again until they, you know, get to the top. And we're talking bones broken in all the wrong places. You're not talking a nice clean break where it's, you're going to get that shit set and it's going to be okay. We're talking just shattered bones. We're talking just horrible pain and just this agony that these people would go through, right? And these are prisoners. And I mean, I feel like way back in the day, there were a lot of times when people didn't even get a trial, and they were just guilty whether they were or not. And so
if the king says you're guilty, you're guilty.
Exactly. And you did not mess with the crown. So anyway, this thing gets dropped on you until you are just a shattered mess of your former self. What would end up happening is, like, you would kind of hope that the executioner would have a little bit of mercy. Like, the fact that there was an executioner and that this person had a job as an executioner, like, how?
What do you go home to? Do you go home to dinner?
After? Oh, you wouldn't believe the kind of day I had, babe.
Oh my goodness, let me tell you about it.
I mean, that breaking wheel. So anyway, like, that's not really enough to kill you, at least not right off the bat. I mean, you could eventually die from, say, I don't know, infection. Or
like, I would think like hemorrhage. Like, I can imagine like a broken femur poking into a femoral artery and you basically bleeding out internally. If you're lucky.
If you're lucky, that's what happens. So most of the time, what would end up happening is at the end of all of this, the person would be beheaded. So it,
what a mercy.
I mean, I thank God for small mercies, right? Eventually, after all of the punishment was done, when they'd perform the decapitation, it was done with a large sword.
That's badass. Sorry, but it is. I mean, the best way to get decapitated is with a large freaking sword. One skillful stroke.
You hope that it's skillful. From what I could tell, there wasn't a whole lot of training that went into becoming an executioner. It's not like something that you went to school for to get a 4-year degree. They were just kind of like, hey, do you want to do this? And they're like, yeah, sure. Give me a shilling.
Enthusiasm would be a really important, just enthusiasm.
Yeah, I totally want to break somebody's entire body. The executioners were not always super skilled at the craft. Like, it could have been the first day on the job. You know, things didn't always go to plan. So you hope that when you are beheaded by that large sword, that it's not, you know, 8 blows later that they get it right.
But the thing is, if it is 8 blows later that they get it right, like, there's really no blowback to them. It's not like you're going to get a bad write-up for doing a shitty execution because you're just going to keep going until the guy is dead, right?
It's so on the job training.
Right. And at this point, you've already like broken every bone in the dude's body. So like further mutilation and pain is not really going to give you demerit points.
No. If anything, you're going to rise the ranks, right? You're going to be a manager.
You got him in his back. You got him in his arm. You got him in this like the side of his skull and his ear. And then you took off his head. Good work.
Great job.
Good job, Jeff.
I was going to call him John. I feel like everybody was named John during this time.
John, there's a lot of Johns.
So after the execution was finally complete and this poor individual was mercifully killed, whether it's 1 or 8 blows later, the breaking wheel victims, even though most of the time, yes, they were most likely criminals of some degree, I think that this qualifies as a victim, so I'm going to use the word victim. They were left exposed to like the environment. Kind of like as a warning to others. And so
like crows and rain and jackals and whatnot.
Yes, exactly that. There isn't a lot in the way of remains of these individuals that still exists. There is one individual who was left that they found a whole skeleton of. Mm. And that person's on display at a museum in Europe.
Oh, all those broken bones.
And the way the display is, it's just everything's crooked and everything's just like mangled and it's...
Did you find that picture online?
I did.
Can you send it to me?
I can.
Okay.
And so it's just a very unfortunate thing because, you know, you kind of wish that there was more evidence so you could kind of see, but they were left on display for years. Mm-hmm. And so... You know, because of that, you know, birds had at them and the wind.
Animals dragged them, drag a leg over here.
They're scattered everywhere.
Over there. Yeah. And because they're, of course, although it's not like you're going to get a femur because the femur's in pieces. So it's like even this is why people dismember. This is exactly why people dismember because it's easy to get rid of a corpse when it's dismembered.
Yeah. I mean, the birds are a help too.
They are.
Great job.
They are.
Great job.
Thanks, birds.
Yeah.
A beautiful species.
The next one, which I'm sure, unless you've been living under a rock, or you're under the age of 3, you've heard of the guillotine. Mm-hmm. Everybody's heard of the guillotine.
It's a classic.
It is. It's a classic method. In case anybody isn't familiar, the condemned individual ends up kind of strapped in like these little stock things, and they're like kind of held down at the bottom of the frame. And so they're positioned with their neck. And so it's kind of like in this little cradle where there's this giant, I'm going to say it looked, to me, it looks like a razor blade. I know
it's a giant freaking blade.
It's a giant freaking blade, you know? And so it just drops. It's heavy. And
they often weighted the top as well. They would put a weight above the blade to make it even heavier.
Yes. When the blade is released, it basically just very forcefully and swiftly takes the head off in one nice, clean cut. it was sort of invented as a more humane method of execution, because prior to that, although they had been, specifically France, I mean, they've used it everywhere to some degree, but specifically France had used a lot of other methods as well as beheading to execute people, but they were extremely prone to error, going back to, you know, John, whose first day on the job, he doesn't know what he's doing, he does not know how to cut somebody's head off.
He takes off like the top third of the head.
He's like, please, God.
Just kill me.
Just do it. Can't you get your manager? It's such a care. You just got that like haircut with the like short in the back. It's stacked up, graduated haircut. Anyway, you people know who you are. And so, yeah, like all these other ones were kind of prone to a lot of error, and people were recognizing the fact that they're, if they were going to put these people to death, that there needed to be a much more humane, quote unquote, humane way of doing this. Thankfully for these people, they lived in the Enlightenment era. So these people, because they were enlightened, came to the conclusion that, hey, you know what? What's better than eight blows? One.
Just the one.
Just one, the good one. One good one, and you're good.
Given the choices of many forms of execution, that death by guillotine, it's pretty to the point.
It really is. I mean, if you hear guillotine, you're like, shit, that is not how I saw today going.
I didn't see it going that way.
And so because they actually did use this for a very long time after it was deemed as quote unquote humane, the last time that this was used was September 10th of 1977.
Shut your mouth.
I told you it was in our lifetime.
1977.
Yeah, the last person was Hamida Dianduby, and that was on September 10th of 1977. In addition to being the last person executed in France, he was also the last person executed by the guillotine by any government in the entire world. So he went out on a bang.
Wow.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
It's impressive.
It is impressive. I don't know actually what France uses at this point, but it certainly isn't the guillotine any longer. Side note, did you know that America is really bringing back the firing squad?
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Wow, the firing squad, huh?
Well, I mean, really, what does America do best? Guns.
Guns. Really spreading out the responsibility, too. That's very humane. Very humane.
I think the prisoner has a choice that they can elect for firing squad. The third method that I found is death by sawing.
Oh.
Death by sawing is really exactly what it sounds like. This was a method where an individual, a living individual, would be strung up upside down, feet hung up by like a frame, like a wooden frame, and they would be cut in half from the groin.
They started with the, oh, they
don't
started
say
with
it.
The groin.
Yep, they did.
I'm not going to say that.
I saw it forming.
Oh, my God. Okay, where did this happen? What country was this?
It was in various countries. Yeah, it was used most frequently in medieval Europe.
Oh, fucking of course it
right.
was.
But if that gives you a sense of when this type of thing was used, it is literally exactly what it sounds like. From the artist renderings, it's like a double-ended saw.
Like the kind that you would use to like take down a big tree.
A big tree, but instead you're taking down a human.
And just sawing them
in half.
Wow.
Yes. Yes.
I do feel like at some point you're going to die. And before they get to your head, you're going to be dead.
Well, well, that's how beautiful.
No, thank you.
And actually, that is mentioned that once they would hit an artery, I mean, most likely you're going to bleed out.
You better fucking hope
so. You hope so. But death by sawing was a commonly used method.
That makes me cross my legs.
I actually am too. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The next one I have is the waist chop or the waist cutting.
Wow, is that just what it sounds like?
It's exactly what it sounds like too. It was a form of execution that was used in ancient China. Very similar to the aforementioned death by sawing, where you're kind of just being bisected at the waist. Like, think of the Black Dahlia.
Where did they start? Oh my God, the Black Dahlia. Mm-hmm. Where did they start? Did they start at the front, the back, the side? Did they go in from the side? Do you want to know the answer?
I think it was, you know, I don't know. I mean, executioner's choice.
Maybe you got a choice as the victim.
From what the pictures, the drawings depicted, it's a person who's on their knees and like bent forward over a wooden bench or a wooden table, and they're being sawn in half.
Jesus Christ.
Yep. And from what we can tell, this first appeared during the Zhao Dynasty, which was 1046 BC through 256 BC. This is
that's like a thousand, ancient, 3,000 years ago.
Ancient
that is a long
times.
Freaking time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they actually had three methods that they used. One is quartering the prisoner alive.
Oh, shit.
The waist chop or beheading. You really hope to fucking God that you get the beheading in that. I'm sorry, but that is.
Say a little prayer.
You just are like, please, God, the wheel of death, just give me the beheading. And sometimes the chopping was not limited to one slice. Absolutely barbaric. There was a poet, Gao Qi, who was a Ming Dynasty poet, who was sentenced by Hong Wu, an emperor, to be sliced into eight parts because of the political satire writing.
You have to be careful that you don't laugh at the wrong people.
That's right. I know. I'm like, I'm afraid to laugh now. What if they hear them?
I know, seriously.
And they come back for me all these years later.
That's horrific. Oh my God. I feel like a couple of cultures really got it going on when it comes to the like punishment methods. Medieval and Inquisition era.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
China, ancient China, ancient Japan, very imaginative people.
They really took it, like their creativity with this shit was off the hooks.
Maximum creativity. You have to, you know, if you don't admire the methods, you have to admire the creativity.
Yeah, no, exactly. Exactly.
A couple of countries just really had it dialed in.
Yeah.
And then there's just like the whole of fucking Europe.
Right. Yeah. They're just like, bring it. What is this?
Whatever. We got it.
Yeah. It's
we
a golden this. Hour of torture.
That's right.
Do you know, though, that in the modern Chinese language, apparently, the phrase waist chop has evolved to become a metaphor for canceling a project or a television program.
Really? That's like it's existed to this day. That's not grim.
Yeah. Like at least in like the evolution of phrasing things. Yeah. Yeah. But my last and most incredibly disturbing, at least in my opinion, is being hanged, drawn, and quartered.
Okay, what does this encompass?
Okay, so at the end of the day, what this boils down to is you don't fuck with the crown.
You don't.
You apparently
can expect a little blowback if you do.
You really can. High treason was probably the worst offense that anybody could possibly ever commit. If you undermined the king's authority, it was game over for you. It was as bad as like physically assaulting. Yep. And so this happened. If you were a man, you would be hanged, drawn, and quartered. If you were a woman, you would not be hanged, drawn, and quartered because of public decency.
Oh.
Our anatomy is apparently inappropriate for the sentence.
And Vahine!
We were drawn, but instead of being quartered, we were burned.
Oh my God. So go through this process because some people might not know about the drawn part, like in Titanic.
Yeah, paint me like one of your French girls.
Exactly. Not like that.
Not at all like that. Well, let me tell you the reasons and then I will tell you all about the how.
Okay.
The things that could get you hanged, drawn, and quartered were imagining the death of a king, his wife, or his eldest son and heir.
Hang on. So like, I'm a little confused because
no, you should be.
The privacy of mental content is confusing. So how did they know that you were imagining it?
They told
I glimmer in your eye.
It was a little glimmer in your eye. I don't know, but
confusing. So don't give the king the side eye.
Do not chicken eye the king.
Moment. Yeah. Chicken eye the king. This is good life advice.
Violating the king. I can't even say this with a straight face. Violating the king's wife.
Oh, that'll do it.
His eldest daughter, if she were unmarried, or the wife of his eldest son and heir. I don't know. I'm like, if she's married, is that cool? Or
it's cool. It's cool. She's
okay.
Married.
She's already been down that road. Levying war against the king in his realm, adhering to the king's enemies in his realm, or giving them aid and comfort in his realm, or elsewhere.
Or elsewhere.
So it's not just limited to the realm.
It's anywhere fucking on the planet.
Yes.
So those things can get you hung, drawn, and quartered.
Yes. There's also counterfeiting, you know, if you counterfeit the king's coinage, importing counterfeit money, killing the chancellor or treasurer, but only while they're in office. Apparently, if they're out of office, you can murder them.
You can go for it.
Yeah. So to go back to your question from before, as far as hanged, drawn, and quartered, and exactly what that means. Like, if I were to listen to that and I didn't know, I would think, oh, hanged, like they're going to be killed because you're hanging them. Oh, no, no, no. Think back to Keith.
It's not that nice.
No. Think back to Keith Hunter Jesperson and the death game that he would play. They would almost die, but then he'd bring them back. Right. That's exactly what this was. So the individual would be hung, and they would be kind of like strung up for however long. I don't know how long it actually takes to die from hanging. Apparently, they would be hung up and almost to the point of death.
Are they hung by their feet, by their hands?
Neck.
They're hung by their neck, right? Mm-hmm. Just to the point. So they're... Mm-hmm. It is the death game. It's the Keith Hunter Jesperson death game, but instead of hands, it's rope.
It's medieval kind. And so after that, what they would do is they would cut them down, and they're almost on the brink of death. They would cut them down, and at that point, they would emasculate them. What I mean by that is exactly, sorry, men in the audience, they would cut it off.
Cut your junk off.
They cut your junk off.
Oftentimes,
they would just go ahead and toss it into the fire that was conveniently burning. And
now, if you're Armin Mivus, you know that that's going to overdo your dick.
Well, you said you braise it. You do not put it into
a braise it. You
flame.
Don't put it into a direct fire. Jesus, how many dicks are you going to come across?
I think these guys came across a lot.
They probably did.
And so after that, they disembowel the person. And that is where the word drawn comes in. And so to draw basically is equivalent to disembowel.
It's like I'm going to draw my knife across your stomach.
And cut out your guts.
Take the parts that are inside and bring them to the outside.
Exactly, exactly. There is some open debate about this, that the way I view this is exactly what you just said. Like, I'm going to, you know, they're eviscerating these people. When these prisoners were taken to their execution, they were taken by horse. And so a lot of people are like, oh, no. They were like drawn behind the horse and dragged.
That's a word that we use regarding horses.
Right. And so
like the horse drew the wagon.
Exactly. And so there's a very, like, there's some discord between that. But the way I'm using this for tonight is that they were cut open and intestines disemboweled, everything. This was often done while the prisoner was potentially still alive.
Oh, God.
Because remember,
not much longer though.
No, because remember though, like, okay, they've been hanged, but then they cut him down before they die. And then they cut off the junk, which is probably a pretty quick, I would think you would bleed a lot from that.
You do bleed out, but there could be some cauterization that happens.
You never know. So at this point, when they disembowel the person, they then oftentimes would go ahead and just behead him. And the quartering comes in by removing the arms from the torso as well as the legs from the torso, in case anybody's unclear as to where the legs live. Prior to the hanging, though, as the prisoner had been held in their little gallows area, they would be taken by horse. They were kind of like strapped to basically a piece of wood. And it was attached to the horse, and they were dragged through the town on display for the public to see them. And they would jeer and throw things at them. And
their rotten tomatoes and their poo.
Yes, that's exactly what it was. You know, whatever they could get their like horrible little meat hooks on, you know, they were throwing it at these people. And so that was, you know, sort of what led up to being hung before all of this other stuff happened. And then after they were dead, finally, mercifully dead, what would happen is, and after they were all dismembered, the limbs would just sort of go where they were needed. And what I mean by that is wherever the crown needed to send a message to, of don't fuck with us, the decedent's head was bound so it wouldn't fall apart from putrefaction.
like the jaw would stay attached and
All of that. And it would be set upon a large spear, like a giant wood spear, and staked into the ground. A lot of times, actually, the heads would be displayed on the London Bridge.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which was the route that so many travelers would take in order to get into the city. And when they would see these heads impaled upon these spears, it would essentially send them a message to, you know, don't practice against the queen.
Yeah.
Is basically what that was. But it's for the rest of the limbs, the arms, the legs, all the rest of it, it would go, like I said, wherever it was needed. And it sent a message and they would leave them there to just continue to rot away. And so it was a constant reminder for the people, and as they would go by, or if it was your town or whatever the case was, it was just like, don't let this happen to you.
Don't mess with the king.
Yes. But even more disgusting, the remains that were like that would be, basically they would be parboiled, which is kind of like partially boiled. And they would be kind of mixed in with things like salt and cumin.
This is sounding more and more delicious by the minute.
Isn't it though? Yeah. Yummy stew night. I mean, it is cold. Foggy London town
rosemary.
Is cold.
Rosemary.
A little pinch of pepper. And so don't forget the garlic. And so what that would do is it would kind of prevent some of the putrefaction from happening. And the cumin would also prevent the birds from pecking at the flesh.
Oh,
apparently birds aren't a fan of cumin. The last example I have was Oliver Plunkett, and he was hanged, drawn, and quartered in July of 1681. His executioner, apparently this was a thing, the executioner could be bribed so that the body parts were saved from the fire that I mentioned earlier, the open flame that was conveniently placed. Oliver Plunkett, his head is on display at St. Peter's Church in Drogheda. Okay, we got to add that to our list.
Seriously. On our like world homicide tour.
Yeah, exactly. And
Drogheda on the map.
And the practice of hanging, drawing, and quartering was actually abolished in England. Oddly enough, not within our lifetime, but pretty close. 1870.
Wow.
Yeah.
Really recent.
Right? I know, it's crazy. Prior to the abolishment of this, there were I lost count how many amendments were made to this punishment. It's really interesting. I had to cut that whole thing. I wanted to talk about it. I'm like, this is like a whole series of podcasts. But if anybody ever wanted to look that up, it is absolutely incredibly amazing how many amendments were made. Like, they thought this out. They're like, no, you know what? This isn't working with the hanging, drawing, and quartering. We're going to have to go ahead and fix this. Keep that. Take away that.
In England, there was this massive push from sort of the Middle Ages onwards about dissection as a way to understand human anatomy. Mm-hmm. And so there was this period of time from like, I think it was like the mid 1700s to about the mid 1800s, where if you were put to death, your chances of ending up as a dissection person who gets dissected by other people.
A dissection person who gets dissected by other people.
By other people. It is the technical name.
Yes.
I did look it up. It's a dissection person who gets dissected by other people.
That's perfect.
That's the shortest they could make it. If you're one of them, then you had it was over 75% chance. If you were put to death, you went onto a sort of like an anatomist table or a scientific table. And this was a big deal. People would come and watch people get dissected. There were public dissections. You might have even seen pictures of these where it's like the person who is dissected by the dissectors mm-hmm. is lying on their bed in the middle of this room. And then there's all these like stacked tiers of balconies where you could look down and you could see it happening.
Yeah.
And they would be filled with all of the doctors-to-be and people who were studying medicine, but they were also filled by the general public who were drawn to watching people get cut apart.
Yeah, dude, I'm not going to lie. I would have been there.
I would have been there.
100,000. As you were talking about that, I'm like, how do I get a ticket?
People loved this shit. It was like going to the movies, but there wasn't movies. There were dissections.
Right, which goes back to the fact that this whole true crime fascination that we have nowadays, like mm-hmm. modern times, is nothing new. We're not original with this.
No, we're not original.
We just have fancier ways of getting it out there. We have fancier mm-hmm. ways of talking about it and meeting. And, you know, when you're 1,400 miles away from your friend, you can just chat over Zoom. And this isn't anything new. This has been going on for ages, millennia.
Fascinated by people doing crazy, terrible stuff. That's really what it comes down to.
I do have one more. My last one is slow slicing.
Oh, I'm concerned that that's just what it sounds like.
Well, it's also known as death by a thousand cuts.
Oh.
And it was a form of torture and execution that was also used in ancient China, roughly from the year 900 until it was banned in 1905.
Okay, the fact that there's a 19 in front of that is very disturbing.
Dude, my grandmother was born in 1913. My grandfather was born in 1909. All right, that was almost within my grandparents' lifetime. That's fucking crazy. Putting it into context, that's not that far away from now.
Yeah, that's right. That was like 116 years.
116.
Yeah. Slow slicing. That's okay. So tell us about death by a thousand cuts.
Okay, so it was very clearly a slow process. It was translated variously as the slow process or the lingering death. It was used as well in Vietnam and Korea.
Hardcore.
It was, yeah, this is pretty hardcore. So, okay, so what this is a knife that is used methodically to remove portions of the body over an extended period of time.
How extended are we talking?
Eventually resulting in death. They don't give a time frame. They say eventually.
I mean, could this be weeks?
It could be days.
Many days.
Many days, multiple days. It was kind of reserved, quote unquote reserved, for crimes that were considered to be an especially heinous crime. So treason is listed as
always top of the fucking list.
It is, actually, it's number one. It was also used if you were a mass murderer. It was used if you killed your parents, patricide or matricide. It was also used, this is back when this was a thing, it was used if the person was a slave and they murdered their master.
Oh.
Or employer. That is kind of what that was reserved for. Emperors also used it to threaten people and kind of like only ordered it sometimes for minor offenses if they so felt.
Just it's a Tuesday and I'm feeling, I didn't get much sleep last night.
I'm feeling some sort of way. Death by a thousand cuts. So it's a little bit difficult to sort of get real true details of the how these executions happened, but they generally consisted to arms, legs, chest, which eventually became the amputation of limbs, which would eventually become a stab to the heart or decapitation.
You better hope it's a step to the freaking heart.
And again, you know, if you had an executioner who was, you know, feeling extra sensey that day and merciful, the first cut would be administered to the throat. So then it would die.
That's the best way to go.
Right. And so the subsequent cuts that happened only happened to a corpse. So when they would be dismembered, of course, it would only be on a corpse as well. And so that was the best that you could sort of hope for with that particular form of torture slash execution.
Seems like the kind of thing that you could, like, your family would bribe somebody a little bit to make sure that first cut was the neck cut.
Yes. And in fact, well, it's also thought that the quote unquote death by a thousand cuts couldn't really have lasted that long. Some people do say that it took days, but if somebody knew what they were doing, they estimate like 15 to 20 minutes. But then I have read, you know, they were just being a dick about it that day. Some of the emperors could order up to like 3 days of cutting. So it could prolong and become a much longer execution. But for the most part, yeah, that's what that was. In addition to that, the flesh of these victims may have also been sold as a medicine.
What malady would it fix?
I don't know.
I bet you $1 million it's bad erections.
Obviously.
It's always bad erections. Like rhinoceros horn?
Bad erection, yeah. I wonder if they labeled it with no headache.
Oh.
Really made it extra appealing.
Yeah, they should have done that. I mean, I don't want to tell you how to do your job, ancient China, but...
but, you know, if you label this with no, like, hangover, no headache, I mean, you're going to sell a lot more.
Everybody's going to buy
Every
it.
Every guy with a floppy weenie is going to be in.
Those were some fun dismemberment methods, Kita.
Weren't
I have
they?
One more to add to that.
Please.
To the mix.
Please.
So you had a lot of good ones, but I only found one that I really wanted to share.
Please go ahead.
It's slicing to pieces by elephant.
Oh,
yeah.
I saw
so
that.
Here's how it goes. I know. There were some elephants in Southeastern Asia around sort of like the 1300s or so. These were these elephants that were trained to kill people. And which I think is terrible because I think of elephants as very peaceful creatures. But I don't know, maybe they were probably super pissed off at people in general. So this was easier for them. So what would happen was these sharp blades would be attached to their feet and not in a way that pierced the elephant's skin, so everyone chill out, but just like almost like a cuff that would go around the elephant's foot, mm-hmm. and then it could stamp on people and cut them up. So this is an actual quote from a traveler visiting Delhi, which is in India, in the 1300s. Yes, this is how it went. On such occasions, the elephant driver rode upon them, and when a man was thrown to them, they would wrap the trunk about him and toss him up, and then take him with the teeth and throw him between their forefeet upon the breast, and do just as the driver should bid them, and according to the orders of the emperor. If the order was to cut him to pieces, the elephant would do so with his irons. His irons were those sharp blades on his feet. And then throw the pieces among the assembled multitude. But if the order was to leave him, he would be left lying before the emperor until his skin should be taken off and stuffed with hay and the flesh given to the dogs.
Fuck.
Yeah, they don't fuck around.
Also, it's an elephant.
Ancient India. It's an elephant.
If it stops you, you're going to die anyway.
But I really feel like the sharpened blades attached to the feet are really going to seal the deal.
That's really, that is going to do the trick right there.
Yeah. Well, that's a little tour of ye olde dismemberment methods throughout history. But as you folks know, a lot of the characters that we have encountered in our cases use dismemberment in their crimes. And so we're going to take just a little tour of that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we have looked at many, approximately 20-ish cases that we've explored so far. And of them, we identified 8 particular people who used dismemberment in the commission of their crimes. And of them, they can really be divided into 3 main categories with a little overlap between the categories. In the first category, we have the sort of convenience and disposal dismemberments. This is like, I've done this. I need to get rid of this body. This is not about anything other than hiding my crime. And the 3 that we've identified of the cases that we have examined are the Israel Keys episode, Snowtown, and Joel Guy Jr. The next that we've identified was the sort of ritualistic or revenge dismemberments. Mm-hmm. And in those, we have Ed Kemper, our lovely Leonarda, the soap maker of Correggio.
Aww.
And Catherine Knight, a crazy Australian with some mad knife skills.
Dude.
And then last, we have the sort of sexually oriented dismemberments of the people that we have examined so far. We have Charmin Armin Mavis.
That's his fighting name, by the way.
The delightful, the always enjoyable Jeffrey Dahmer. So here we have a bunch of these really interesting people. So we're going to start out just really with the most mundane of the 3, which is the convenience and disposal. Mm-hmm. So our very first Homicide Worldwide.
Our fledgling episode, if you will.
Our fledgling episode, mm-hmm. was Israel Keys, which was a very fascinating serial killer who operated almost completely under the radar until right before his arrest. So Israel Keys, his last victim was Samantha Koenig. She was 18 years old. When we did this episode, we kind of started out with her because that's where it all began. And he kidnapped her. He sexually assaulted her. He killed her. And then he left her body in a shed and he went to New Orleans, as you do. Now, this was happening in Alaska.
Yeah, a little 2-week vacay.
And this is Alaska in February, which you know it's not balmy.
No. And if you've never been to Alaska in February, you at least know that Alaska's cold.
You at least should know. If you don't know that, then we don't have any hope for you. He goes down to this like pre-planned cruise that he goes to, and then he comes back and he does all this weird stuff with her body. He puts makeup on it. He takes photos for this weird thing he's doing with the news, but then he needs to get rid of her. And at that point, it's a straight up no ritual, no sexual, just straight up dismemberment and get rid of her. He ended up going quote unquote ice fishing. He had this like ice fishing shed that you could put up very easily. And so he went out to this lake called Matanuska Lake, which is north of Anchorage, and he dismembered her body and disposed of it there. So straight up disposal method. Snowtown was another one of our episodes. If you got a chance to listen to that one, it's also sometimes called the bodies in the barrel episodes. And although convenience and disposal were certainly the reasons that John Bunting and his shitty ass friends put those bodies into those barrels, at the same time, there's definitely like some overlap there with a ritualistic. Australia is a really big place. Yeah. And there's a lot of things like empty mines, a lot of desolate, desolate places where you can put things that will never be discovered. And I mean never. I mean, to put it in context, Australia is 80% the size of the continental United States.
Shit.
With the population of the greater Los Angeles metropolitan area. There's like 25 million people who live there. And it's 80% the size of the continental United States. It's a big fucking place with a lot of nothing. It should be effortless to hide a body. The fact that John Bunting kept these disarticulated bodies in these barrels, I mean, partly convenience to be able to move them around mm-hmm. and hide them, but at the same time, he could have gotten rid of them and he didn't. So actually a very large element of inconvenience that went along with keeping those bodies in those barrels and trying to hide them.
I would think that would be massively inconvenient.
Wouldn't you think so? So that almost does in our convenience disposal element, but at the same time, it was how they hid the bodies. Yeah. You know, they eventually put them into that disused bank vault in Snowtown in South Australia and kind of locked the door and just kind of ignored them until they were discovered. And that takes us to our last sort of convenience and disposal dismemberment of the ones we've done. It's just such a recent one, Keita, and it's one that we just can continue to not like because he's so not likable.
He's such a tool.
Oh, we just can't stand him. He's awful.
I cannot stand him.
It's Joel Guy Jr. Those of you who's like, yeah.
I referenced in that he is the COVID of people. Like if COVID had like an actual human form, he would be COVID.
Joel Guy Jr. was a moron, and but he was a very methodical moron. So, a part of Joel Guy Jr.'s thing, if you haven't listened to our episode yet, which you bloody well should, because it's actually one of my personal favorites.
Actually, it was one of mine too.
So, Joel Guy Jr. basically he killed his parents for money, and not that much money. $500,000 doesn't get you that far these days. So, Joel Guy Jr., after he killed his parents quite horribly. Multiple stabbings. They were both stabbed, I think, more than 30 times. After that, he dismembered them, put their bodies into large Rubbermaid containers with sort of caustic liquids mm-hmm. to dissolve the bodies. Such a giant dumbass. One of the things that he did was he got this notebook and he wrote down his entire plan. It's very genius plan.
Knives.
With an F. It's with a V, people. It's a plural. This is English. It doesn't make any sense.
It needs to be drawn and quartered immediately.
High fucking treason. So he ended up, after he killed his parents, he ended up taking them apart and trying to dispose of their remains. He got his hand hurt in the struggle with likely his father. And so he ended up having to drive away and get his hand ended to. And in that time, his crimes were uncovered. But he definitely tried to use dismemberment as a way to dispose of their bodies. And one of his goals was to dissolve the bodies.
Yeah.
And then, quote, this is a direct quote from his list of things to do, was flush chunks. Just flush the chunks of them down.
What a winner.
He's a total winner. He tried to boil away the flesh from his mother's head by putting her head in a pot on the stove with those same horrible chemicals. Just awful. But he obviously failed miserably because he was a giant failure at everything.
Nothing about the way they were discovered was convenient. There was nothing that was going to be... The only one that I think anyway had any measurability of convenience was Israel Keyes.
Absolutely.
Because he was, okay, this is what I have to do. Okay, I'm going to do this and I'm going to take her here and I'm going to dispose of her there and mm-hmm. I'm going to drive away. And that's
right.
These two fools, John Bunting and Joel Guy Jr., did not do that. They made a mess.
I mean, there's so many things that could have gone right and they made so many things go wrong just by being, as you said, fools.
They're total fools.
Yeah.
Unlike them, our ritualistic revenge people... They are driven by a much different driver.
No, they are. And you know what? They are much more interesting to me.
Oh, 100%. I mean, even though I found Israel Keyes interesting, I feel like as we moved forward throughout the progression of this podcast, like, and we kind of got to know some of these people, if you will, I did find them a lot more interesting.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we're going to start out with one of the big ones. So in terms of the sort of canon of serial killers in the United States, Ed Kemper definitely rates pretty high. Mm-hmm. And he had a very screwed up relationship with his mother. Profoundly, you think your relationship with your mom is bad? Research Ed Kemper.
Oh, you'll yeah.
Way better about her.
Everybody's going to be like, oh my God, my mom is a
my
saint.
Mom is the best. She's so cool. Oh my
God. I love you, Mom.
Love you, Mom. You're not Ed Kemper's mom. And that's what makes you awesome.
Yeah.
So Ed Kemper had a lot of, well, problems, basically. But he also, he did a lot of murders where there was an overlap of sex, but the ritualistic element was acting out revenge fantasies against his mother.
Iramatio.
Oh, yeah. So Iramatio is this thing that happened when he finally, after killing a lot of people who weren't his mother, he couldn't handle it not being her anymore. And he killed her.
Yeah.
And then he took off her head. So there's our dismemberment element. But then he did something to it. Something that was a new word for Sally. And possibly for Kita too.
No, it was definitely a new word for Kita.
That's right. An iramatio. And the atio is the same atio and fellatio. So that gives you a hint that it's a little sexy, sexy times. But it's basically it's forcibly having sex with somebody's head. And in this case, he did it to his mom's severed head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not so hot.
It's not. It's of. It's many things, but hot.
It's not.
None of them. Certainly not.
It's not.
Blech. And really, when you look at whether or not it's a ritualistic or a sexual component, if it was sexual, he could have kept on going after he killed his mom because the driver would be separate from her. But it wasn't because of sex that he killed. He did get sexual gratification from it, but primarily it was this, it was to enact revenge upon his mother. And when he finally did that, he was pretty much rid of the need to kill.
Mm-hmm.
Killed one more time after that, but it was part of the same killing, and it was as an attempt to hide what he had done to his mother so that he could kind of escape. But
yeah.
Then he ended up just admitting to the whole thing anyway. But that was almost incidental. But once that happened, he said, I mean, he was very honest about this. He said, the need to do it, the need to keep killing just left me. So his was definitely this ritualistic or kind of revenge type of dismemberment.
Yes, definitely.
Then we have the fascinating Leonarda Cianciulli, soap maker of Correggio.
She really was fascinating, wasn't she?
She was. And that was, when you say ritualistic, I mean...
Ritualistic is the word.
It is the word, mm-hmm. Because she... If you don't know the story, you should, again...
Episode 13, people.
Go back and look at it. So Leonarda was a mom, and she had something like 20 pregnancies, and 17 of them resulted in either miscarriages or dead babies.
Oh,
horrible,
God.
Horrible, horrible situation. She only had a couple of living children. Her oldest son was the apple of her eye. And when it seemed like he was going to be drafted into the army, into Benito Mussolini's army, mm-hmm. to fight on the front, she realized that his death was likely. Mm-hmm. And so she had always been very interested and passionate and really quite obsessed with the occult and spells and witchcraft and things like that. And she really went for it. She was like,
she certainly did.
She went for it. She's like, what do I need to do to stop my son from being killed? She went deep. She read all that she could read. She researched, and she realized that, and this is true for pretty much any realm of magic that you want to put into, that if you want to save a life, you kind of have to give a life. This idea of cosmic balance. And so she created this murderous rampage really as a way to save her son from death in Mussolini's army. So she killed these old women. She made all these ruses to stop her from being found out that she was killing them. She would kill them in her kitchen where she made soaps and made food for people, and she would boil them down and cut up their bodies and make them into soap.
And tea cakes and feed them to people.
Cakes.
So she sort of crossed over into some cannibalism.
She crossed a lot of freaking lines.
She really did. She was sort of a pioneer of murder.
She was. That's the way she was a murder pioneer.
A murder pioneer, as was the next person, which is Catherine Knight.
Oh, an Australian makes me feel so proud. So again, with the ritualistic and revenge element here for dismemberment, Catherine Knight was a very skilled abattoir worker, and she had many boyfriends. She was quite a violent lady. She was very unstable. And her last boyfriend, John Price, she stabbed him to death. She skinned him. Now, as an abattoir worker, she had her own set of extremely sharp knives. She was very, very proud of these knives. She had mad knife skills. She'd been doing this for a long time. She took his skin off in one piece.
I still am, I mean, I don't want to use the word marvel, but like, I kind of marvel at this.
I'm slightly impressed.
You know, because that is not, your skin isn't designed to come off your body. And
it's not your dick, dudes. It's your skin. Armin. She ended up taking his skin off in one piece, essentially. So the police called it a pelt. Mm-hmm. I hate that word because it just sounds so, I think of a bear or like a mink or something.
Oh, God.
So when Catherine Knight skinned him, she actually was able to take like the nostrils and the eyelids and like the genitals. It was a really technically impressive feat, regardless of how you feel about it. It was a technically impressive feat.
It's
it was
very horrific. Professional.
Then she cooked him up and she tried to serve him to his kids. So that part was less professional. Again, this was like massive revenge. It was like, I'm not going to just kill you. I'm going to take you apart spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to defame your memory by doing something so horrific that the people who follow you, which are your children, will always have a memory of you that is tainted.
Right.
She tried to taint him for all time.
You said taint.
I'm so hoping you would notice. And it thrills me that
so
you
sorry.
Did. So our last kind of dismemberment flavor, apart from convenience and disposal and ritualistic and revenge, our last one takes us to sexual. And we have two particular people here. We're going to finish with the big one, but we're going to start with Charmin Armin Mivas.
Yeah. Get ready to rumble.
Rumble with Charmin Armin. So by the way, can I just point out to you something terrible? And that is that Google, when you Google Armin Mivas, Google identifies Armin Mivas as, I quote, a German former computer repair technician. Okay, Google, that's not what he's fucking famous for, okay? He tried to barbecue a dick. That's what he's famous for. It's nothing to do with his computer technician repair skills, Google.
No.
Okay, get your fucking act together. You know all the German cannibal stories? He was kind of the genesis of that.
Yes.
So Charmin Armin had a desire for cannibalism. And it was kind of related to the story of Hansel and Gretel that he heard when he was a kid. As he hit puberty, it all kind of blended together into this sort of like cannibal sexy times weirdness. So during his adolescent years, this really kind of came to a head. And then as he entered adulthood, this combination of cannibalism and sex really coalesced in his mind. Mm-hmm. And so he put this nice little announcement on the internet. He found a couple of, you know, websites where people talked about cannibalism. And he's like, hey, if you're a guy that wants to be eaten, I'm a guy that wants to eat you.
Yeah, just putting it out there, man. If you don't like it, send it right back.
Yeah, send it right back, man. Just putting it into the universe. And so he actually hooked up with a guy. They found each other. And you know what? My kink hooks up with your kink, and together our kinks shall meet. And that's what happened. He came to Armin's house, and they, if you're a guy, just clench yourself because here it comes. They cut off his penis of the guy who came to his house, and then they tried to cook it, and they overcooked it.
Uh-huh.
It's not the right texture to cook it the way they did. It's a reason that penis is not often on menus. And that's because it's both very sort of spongy and very tough at the same time.
Yeah.
It has this weird spongy, tough quality to it.
I'd imagine like calamari to a degree.
It's like calamari. You got to really, really chew your way through it. It's like there's a lot of like tendons and stuff. It's all these like loose tendons and stuff. And then when you get a boner, you're all of these sort of loose places fill up with wood. I'm saying
so if you're Pinocchio, like, maybe.
So basically, you have to imagine that, you know, I don't think we need to go this far. I think we need to back the fuck up. And I'm talking about this is too disgusting. Okay. So Charmin Armin was a dismemberer, but literally the member that he was dismembering was a member. So it was, dismember was completely accurate.
Yes.
And also very literal here.
In this, yes, in this regard, it was quite literal.
It was quite literal. And that takes us to our last sort of example, our last flavor of dismemberment. We've talked about the sexual Armin, but now we're going to talk about sexual Jeffrey.
Wait, he was a male Gemini. Why do I feel such a kinship?
I know. It's because they're so weird, like we're weird.
He is weird. He's weird AF, but...
You know, Jeffrey Dahmer, the thing that really gets me about Jeffrey Dahmer is that Jeffrey Dahmer... despite being a vicious serial killer,
right,
was neither sadistic nor violent.
No.
He really wasn't. He's almost the saddest serial killer in some regards.
He is the saddest serial killer with his, like, dead fish handshake with Stone Phillip.
That really is, like, the metaphor for Jeffrey Dahmer. Yes. He's just, like, he didn't connect. He didn't connect with the world. He didn't connect with other people. What he did connect with was trying to understand the physical world by taking it apart. The way that a child might try to understand how, like, a radio works by taking it apart. But he did that with physical things.
Yes.
And then when he hit puberty, unfortunately, this is what happens a lot. When you already have a weird obsession and then sex comes into it and they just kind of blend together in the old brain pan.
That's so weird.
It is weird. And that's what happens with Jeffrey Dahmer. He's this desire to take things apart and to dismember them and to explore their insides kind of... that all happened.
And to possess them.
To possess them, to have them entirely his, to dominate.
There was so much more going on with him, I feel like. Go back to all the ones that you talked about. For me, with the Jeffrey Dahmer situation, it's like, you know, there was the sexual element, the repression behind, you know, his sexual identity. There was the taking things apart, like you mentioned, the inability to connect on a real level with anything, anybody, his abandonment. And so it's like, there is an element behind him that it's just, it's like you said, he's just the saddest serial killer. There was so much heaviness around him that I don't know why. I just felt differently. Obviously, like, his victims, like, that fucking sucks, you know, and nobody should go through that. And I'm not condoning that in any way, but, you know, there's, his psychology and who he was just so different from everybody else. He's different.
I agree. And you know what? If you had to ask me, who do you want to be a victim of a serial killer? I'd be Jeffrey Dahmer's. Because you know what Jeffrey Dahmer did? He put a nice little cocktail in your drink. Yeah. You'd go to sleep. You'd never wake up.
Right.
He would do horrible things to your dead body. He'd cut you up. He'd eat you. He'd, like, pose you in these weird fucking positions after he, like, cut you apart. But... you're already dead.
You don't fall into his victimology, though. You're not a man.
I don't. So many ways I don't. Almost every way I don't fall into his victimology.
Glad you and I were safe.
No, that's right.
He's going to be like, you're not my jam, either of you.
You're not my jam. We'll just be friends.
Exactly.
I'll bring you some... to the very best degree that I can be with my inability to interact.
To connect, yes. I'll bring you some chocolate.
Blah. But yeah, so his was very, very much sexual driven, just the way that Armin's was. So there are the three elements of dismemberment. So there's the convenience and disposal element, and then there's the ritualistic and revenge element. And then finally, the sexual element of dismemberment, which is almost the hardest one to understand, I think.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. Well, folks, this has been a tour of dismemberment. It's a big part of the cases that we cover. And like all human taboos, it's fascinating. And because humans are awful, it won't be the last you hear of it.
No, it won't. It wouldn't have been hard for the earliest humans to imagine taking each other apart. After all, they saw animals do it to each other all the time. A sharp rock and some serious effort, and suddenly you have proof of your dominance. Proof in the form of a hand or an arm, or even that most potent symbol of defeat, a decapitated head. The others would fear you. The dismembered body of your defeated enemy would remain as a message, establishing your power. Disarticulation of the physical body has always been part of our human experience. In war and combat, ritual and religion, myth and legend, and most recently in our history, in science and medicine, And of course, because humans are generally terrible, it occurs in criminology, but not as often as you might think. Our natural human disgust when faced with a dismembered body is designed to keep us safe, to make us flee in case whatever happened to that guy happens also to us. It's hard to overcome that, but the charmers we encounter in our episodes fall within the roughly 2% of killers who can overcome that innate revulsion and do the unthinkable. I'll close out today's little journey through dismemberment by sharing a diary entry from a spectator of a public dissection that took place in London in 1767. It captures that compelling spirit of horror and fascination. After waiting an hour in the lobby of the Surgeon's Hall, I got by with great difficulty to see the body of Mrs. Brownrigg, which, cut as it is a most shocking sight. I wish I had not seen it. How loathsome our vile bodies are when separated from the soul. You've been listening to Homicide Worldwide. Everybody's really thinking that we all just need to, if we were all living in a yurt the way that we're supposed to, right? We're supposed to live in these like little communities of like 150 to 300 people or something like that. And everyone sees each other shit and have sex and die and get sick. And no, they do. It's like, there's no secrets in a tribe, right? Everyone sees everything all the time. Like, you know, a couple who's having sex and lying down next to like the dude who's slowly dying of an arrow wound. I mean, I don't know.
It's all just a giant.
It's just a giant pile of just humanity. And so, you know, this is only weird to us because we're so detached